I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. It is the anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, and we have a very special show for you today dealing with what exactly happened on 9/11/2001. Specifically, we're honing in on the potential relationship between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the events of that day. Joining us to do that is journalist Dan Christensen of the Florida Bulldog, formerly the Broward Bulldog. And he'll be telling us his story about investigating the Sarasota connection to 9/11. We'll also be discussing the executive order by Joe Biden calling for the declassification review of 9/11 records, the 9/11 victims' families lawsuit, and an FBI investigation known as Operation Encore. All that and more on this September 11th edition of Parallax Views with our guest, Dan Christensen. It's been 20 years since the attacks of 9/11/2001, and with that in mind, let's get right to the conversation. Welcome to Parallax Views, award-winning investigative reporter of the Florida Bulldog, Dan Christensen. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I'm glad to finally have you on the show because I've been wanting to discuss with someone the issue of 9/11 in light of the 9/11 families lawsuit involving Saudi Arabia. But before we get into that, maybe for my listeners, you could discuss your work with the Florida Bulldog, which, you know, I have some friends in Florida, actually, that are big fans of it.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Well, Florida Bulldog is a not-for-profit news organization. I'm actually based in Fort Lauderdale, but we cover South Florida, and we also cover the state of Florida. And we've for the last 10 years, sort of as an outlier, we've covered the events of 9/11 because of the Florida connection to 9/11, which is substantial.
So how did you first become involved in looking into September 11th and the Florida connection to it?
Well, I got a call from a guy named Anthony Summers.
Author of the 11th Day, correct?
Yes. Yes. He and his wife, Robin Swan, had written the book. It was about to come out in the summer of, I guess it was August, actually, of 2011. And Tony had found out about this situation in Sarasota, asked me if I would be interested in helping out, because he and Robin live in Ireland, and I'm obviously in Florida. So, and I've known Tony for a long time. And I said, yeah. And that's how I got aboard on this whole thing. And then after the story began to build, Tony, you know, is an author, and he went off to write other books. And I stayed on with looking at both what happened here in Florida and also what's happening up in New York in the lawsuit.
So I myself, when it comes to 9/11 and looking into the hijackers, what I'm most familiar with is actually the connection in California with Al-Hazmi and Al-Midhar and Omar Al-Bayoumi. But for you, you've been looking at the Sarasota connection. Of course, we know that some of the hijackers were training at a flight school in Florida, but maybe you could walk us through what the sort of deeper Sarasota connection is.
Well, some of the hijackers trained actually at several different Florida flight schools, as they did in California, Arizona, and elsewhere. The flight school where they took most of their lessons, as I understand it, or a significant portion of them, was in Venice, which is about 10 miles south of Sarasota. And our connection to the case came when Tony found out about an FBI investigation that had been conducted into a family that lived there and their apparent connections to Muhammad Atta and some of the other hijackers. Tony had met up with a counterterrorism agent who told him this story. It had been 10 years and the story had never come out, and the agent was concerned as to why it had not. And so we started looking into it. We talked not just to the agent, but other people that were familiar with it. We ended up writing a story for Florida Bulldog that the Miami Herald picked up the same day and ran on their front page. And after the story appeared, before the story appeared, we contacted the Justice Department, and they said that they had no comment on what we were writing. After the story appeared, the FBI contacted not me, but another reporter, or a reporter at the Miami Herald, where I used to work, and said that indeed there had been an investigation. They confirmed that, but they said that it had found no connection to the 9/11 plot. I believe that was their exact phraseology. And so from there, we decided, or I decided, to file a Freedom of Information Act request to try and get their files on the matter. They're saying there's nothing to this. Please explain to us why you reached that conclusion. The case was pending for about a year. We didn't hear anything from them of any substance. So about a year later, we filed suit against them with our attorney, a guy named Tom Julin, who's a fine First Amendment lawyer in Miami, who's sort of become our general counsel, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. And about 6 months after we filed the lawsuit, I went out to the mailbox, and there was an envelope from the FBI with a number of documents in it, the most significant of which was a highly redacted document, redacted for both privacy and national security reasons, that said that the family that we were looking at had, quote, many connections, unquote, to people that were involved in 9/11.
So real quickly here, that family, and I hope I'm getting all the facts right and not mispronouncing names. That's the family of Abdulaziz Al-Hiji, right?
Yes. He and his wife, Anu. The story that we fleshed out here was that about 2 weeks before the 9/11 attacks, the Al-Hijis had moved out of their home, which was in an upscale neighborhood in a development called Prestancia, which is actually immediately south of Sarasota. And they traveled to Washington first, where they hooked up with Anoud Al-Hijji's father, a guy named Hassam Ghazali, and they all left the country and went back to Saudi Arabia. Shortly after, we don't know the precise timing on this, but shortly after the attacks, neighbors started to call the FBI and local sheriff's office and stuff, saying, hey, look, there's some very strange circumstances here. These people moved out of their homes. They left behind their cars, and apparently all their belongings, and disappeared. And so at some point, several weeks after 9/11, a group of sheriff's office and people from the development went into the home, found that indeed they had left. They left their furniture, they left their clothing, they'd left food on the kitchen counter. There was a safe that was open in the bedroom that was there, and I think three cars, one of which they had just purchased, and they were gone, and there was no explanation for it. So that triggered an FBI investigation that came to the conclusion that these folks had many connections with people involved in 9/11. Now, we know a little bit about that. Supposedly, a relative of the Al-Hijji's had been a flight was taking lessons at the same locations as the hijackers were in Venice. And but beyond that, we don't know too much about exactly what it is that led the FBI to conclude this, or to conclude, as they told me, that there was no connection to all this, what had happened. Again, that's why we filed the FOIA request, and we started to get other documentation about this. We found that there was at Bradenton, which is a city nearby, Sarasota, the police there found in a garbage, not a garbage can, but one of those big bins that they have outside a warehouse where people store stuff. They found somebody had seen a Middle Eastern guy, appeared to be a Middle Eastern, throwing away stuff, and they checked and they saw that there were flight plans. There were all sorts of stuff indicating that there was something unusual happening to this particular person. Like there was a last will and testament. There was flight documents, and they were all found around the same time. So we got all these little tidbits about what was happening in the area, but we've never put together the entire story. The FBI has said essentially that they don't have any more records on that. They lied to it, which we don't believe.
And of course, Al-Hijji, I think, has actually addressed these claims and said, I am deeply saddened by all of this. And, you know, I love the USA. I was not in any way connected to any of this.
Yes, Tony Summers and a reporter for the Daily Telegraph in London caught up with him. We knew from some of the information, the documents, that at some point he apparently had moved to London. We caught up with him there. He denied having any involvement in this. And, that was that.
So for my listeners, what for you and Tony Summers and also Robin Swan, what's the most important thing to get out of this aspect of the 9/11 story, this figure of Al-Hijji?
Well, we found out some additional stuff about all this, and that indicated that Mr. Al-Hijji was an acolyte of Osama bin Laden. There was a guy who told the FBI in 2004, another guy of Arab descent, that Al-Hijji had tried to get him to travel to Afghanistan and Pakistan to fight, and also once introduced him to a guy at a soccer game in Sarasota at a mosque there, whose name was, he was the guy from South Florida who later became an Al Qaeda figure. There was a $5 million bounty on his head, Adnan Shukrijumov. Anyway, all that, you know, sort of added to the mystery of all this. The guy that told us this, he also told the FBI, he told me in a series of communications that I had with him from prison where he's doing time for weapons and other violations in a terrorist-related case. So there's all this strange stuff, and we do not have a resolution as to what all this is about. But it appears to be a support network for the hijackers. We knew that the hijackers, including Mohammed Atta, had traveled to the home, and that was established by, according to this, our sources, by gatehouse records at the Prestancia development. There were photographs of the license plates of cars that go in and out, and apparently they traced, some of them traced back to Atta and some of the other hijackers. They also had to sign in on sheets of paper, and those apparently also came back to Oaxaca. And all this was turned over to the FBI, according to our sources. The FBI has said that, nope, we never got them. So, again, we are sort of scratching our heads. But we do know one thing, and that is that former Senator Bob Graham is not happy with the FBI's explanation. Bob Graham was the co-chairman of Congress's joint inquiry into 9/11. And when Tony and I found out about this, we contacted him, we met him, I told him about this, and he was pretty upset because he said that the FBI had promised to provide his inquiry with everything it had at the time. And they didn't provide this. They also didn't provide this to the 9/11 Commission. This didn't come out until we first reported it in 2011, which was 7 years after the 9/11 Commission went out of business. So why did they keep it secret for so long? We don't know. They have offered no explanation.
I actually wanted to ask you a bit more about Senator Graham. You've spoken to him, obviously. What's his sort of basic take on all of this? And what was your feel of him?
Well, his basic take on all this is that the FBI has been lying. He contends that they lied to the joint inquiry. They withheld evidence from the joint inquiry. And, he's puzzled by it, let's put it that way. And when he heard about this, this just added to his concerns about how the FBI had approached this whole case.
Now, I know you're a journalist, so you don't really speculate, but has anyone offered reasons as to why the FBI would sort of want to conceal all of this?
Well, after spending a lot of time on this, I've talked with Tom Julin, our attorney, about all this, and I think others kind of believe this too, is that there were geopolitical concerns that led the Bush administration to sort of put the kibosh on obtaining information about Saudi Arabia. I mean, we do know that 3 days after 9/11, the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, was at the White House. There's a very interesting photograph of him sitting on the Truman balcony with President Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Vice President Cheney, and others, apparently talking about what had just happened, because this was on September 13th. Prince Bandar looks in that picture very comfortable, very relaxed. He's sitting there with his legs outstretched. It appears as if he's got a cigar in his hand, a way that probably neither you or I would sit if we were in the presence of the President of the United States at the White House. We tend to think that some deal was cut at that point. Exactly what it was, we don't know. But there seems to be no other explanation here for why the FBI would do what it did, and certainly in Sarasota, and apparently in other areas too, because we also know of Operation Encore.
I wanted to ask you about Operation Encore for my listeners that may be unfamiliar with it.
Yeah. Operation Encore was an FBI investigation that began around 2006 or seven, and apparently was something of a renegade investigation within the FBI by agents that believed that Saudi Arabia was complicit in what happened. And it went on for a number of years, and it was done in secret. Nobody knew about this. Florida Bulldog got the first concrete information about it in 2016 as part of our lawsuit, our second FOIA lawsuit, which was seeking documents of an entity called the 9/11 Review Commission, which was set up by the FBI to sort of look at the recommendations that had been made by the original 9/11 Commission and determine whether or not those recommendations had been instituted, and also to look at new evidence that had come up since the 9/11 Commission went out of business. And one of the things they looked at was Sarasota. And they said that they talked to the agent that wrote that many connections memo, and that the agent couldn't give them a good reason as to why he wrote it. And they also called it wholly unsubstantiated and poorly written. So, and they made some other adverse comments about our investigation. So we wanted again to determine what was the basis for their statements. So I filed a FOIA request, which was completely ignored by the FBI. Then with Tom Julin, we sued them under the Freedom of Information Act, seeking the documents that had been relied on by the commission to reach its conclusions. Now, this was an interesting commission, by the way. It was a three-person commission, sort of headed in a de facto way by Ed Meese, the former attorney general under President Reagan. And they were sort of bought and paid for by the FBI, literally. They each had contracts with the FBI, and they were paid salaries, I forget the amount, substantial salary. And, excuse me, and they were also spoon-fed information by the FBI. When you read the report, you could see how that unfolded. And we reported on all that at the time. But what they didn't do was explain why they came to the conclusion that there was nothing there. They didn't identify the agent that wrote the report. But they sort of threw him under the bus by saying he didn't know what he was talking about. So again, we wanted to find out what was happening, so we sued. And we did get several thousand pages of documents ultimately. But the one thing that we got that proved to be the most significant thing was a highly redacted four-page, what was called an FBI summary, that was written in early October 2012. It was a document about what we later came to know was Operation Encore. But we didn't know it was Operation Encore at the time because they blanked out the name, the title, Operation Encore. But in that document, it showed that as of 2012, they were looking to charge somebody for providing material support to the hijackers out in Southern California. It also identified several suspected Saudi agents who had been identified publicly before, but also said that they had been tasked, that's their word, with helping the hijackers by a third person whose name was redacted from the report. Now, that name was later made public, actually on orders from President Trump, after he met with some of the family members of 9/11. And then it was supposed to be kept secret, but it wasn't, because the FBI made a mistake, or some U.S. attorneys made a mistake, filed the name in the public document. So we know who that person was. His name is Mossad Al-Jarrah. And he, at the time of 9/11, or prior to 9/11, was a ranking member of the Ministry of Islamic Affairs, and was assigned to the Saudi embassy in Washington. And he's the guy that, according to the FBI document, tasked these other two people with helping the hijackers after they arrived. Two of the guys, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Nidar, and they were aboard American Airlines Flight 77 when it crashed into the Pentagon. So that was the flight that was involved and the hijackers that were involved. There were actually a team of five hijackers that were on that flight. These two guys were part of the what they call the muscle hijackers, who apparently prevented the passengers from intervening.
Now, I mentioned Al-Bayoumi earlier, and there's also another figure, I believe, and I feel bad, I will mispronounce names.
Al-Thumari.
Yes, Al-Thumari. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about those two figures? I think some of my listeners are also already familiar with Al-Bayoumi, but just for listeners that may be unfamiliar.
Sure. Those were the two guys that were also named in this report. Fahad Al-Thumari was an accredited diplomat of Saudi Arabia. He was also an imam at the Culver City Mosque, the King Fahd Mosque. And Al-Bayoumi was purportedly a student, although he was a bit old for that, who was also suspected of being a Saudi agent. He apparently worked for a Saudi company in a no-show job, and yet, was paid by the Saudi government. So those were the two guys that were on the receiving end of orders to help the hijackers, according to this particular document. And the hijackers, we know, did go to that particular mosque. Now, apparently both Thumari and Bayoumi have denied assisting them. And they were recently deposed again in the civil lawsuit. We don't know what they had to say because their depositions, like the depositions of everybody else in the case, are all subject to an FBI protective order and are not public.
And how does Prince Bandar tie into this current civil lawsuit?
Well, Prince Bandar was actually one of the original defendants in this, and he got let out for a variety of different reasons. But he had been subpoenaed. He was the ambassador from, I guess it was either the late 80s or early 90s, through 2005 or 6. I'm maybe wrong on those dates, but for quite some time, he was the Saudi ambassador to the United States. He was very well connected. He was very well liked. Matter of fact, he was very close to both Presidents Bush and actually had gained the nickname Bandar Bush because of that. Anyway, he had been subpoenaed by the plaintiffs, by the families, the 9/11 families, to testify in this matter. His testimony, which he had resisted giving for a long time, was actually approved by the court. Sanctioned by the court, but he refused to testify, and the Saudis refused to make him available, saying that he was no longer an employee of the government.
One question that I always get, and again, this is a little bit speculative. People always ask me, well, the Saudi Arabia is considered a United States ally. You mentioned, you know, geopolitical considerations. Why would they be complicit then with these 9/11 hijackers?
Well, that's the $64 question, I guess. I don't think that, and I certainly don't believe that the king at the time believed that this specific events were going to happen. But there seems to have been a deal with the devil that was cut here when, Osama bin Laden was assisted by the Saudis in exchange for not messing with the Saudis themselves and the Saudi government. And that appears to be, you know, how this whole thing unfolded. Do most people that I'm aware of, and do I think that, Saudi government was actually complicit in allowing attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center? No. But I think that they set the stage for what happened here, and I believe that they assisted and perhaps turned a blind eye to what was happening here.
I've actually had former FBI agent Mark Rosini on my program. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but Rosini's view, having worked in the CIA's Bin Laden unit, seems to be, he sort of speculates that ultimately this may have been an issue where the Mabahith or the Saudi intelligence services, for my listeners, were maybe trying to, you know, bring back these wayward Saudis, these hijackers, without incident. And I know this is speculative, but do you think that's a possibility as well? You know, that, you know, maybe they thought they could do all this quietly and not expect something like this to happen, 9/11.
Well, since we don't have any answers here, I think anything is possible. I have no knowledge one way or the other about any of that. You got to remember here, I'm a local South Florida reporter. I cover what's happening in the state of Florida, the governor, the county commission and stuff. So I am not an expert on Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia or any of those things. I've never been there. All I know is what happened here and what the documentation that we've been able to obtain shows. And, so my opinions about geopolitical matters are pretty close to worthless.
That's fair enough. That's one thing I appreciate. You sort of stick to the facts. And recently you've been releasing a lot of articles on the Florida Bulldog website about the families lawsuit. For people that are interested in the families lawsuit, you've been covering that. What are sort of the main points right now? What are the latest developments?
I guess the basic thing you need to understand about the suit was it was filed initially shortly after 9/11, and it was in 2002, and then was dismissed. And it took an act of Congress and an override of President Obama's veto to provide for legislation that allowed this lawsuit to go forward, because the Saudis, like all governments, have sovereign immunity privileges. And it was until this, what was called JASTA law, was passed, the lawsuit was going nowhere. When that passed, the lawsuit was sort of resurrected proceeded, and then in 2018, the judge issued a ruling that allowed it to continue. It rejected a Saudi motion to dismiss, but it also narrowed the focus of the lawsuit, so that, for instance, they were looking solely at what happened in Southern California. All efforts are looking at that. They're not looking at what happened in Florida. They're not looking at what happened in Arizona. in Virginia, in other places around the country. And so that's why there has been an exclusive focus by the plaintiffs in terms of the depositions they're taking and the documents they're seeking about what happened in Southern California and whether or not Al Bayoumi and Al Fumeri had connections to the Saudi government that helped them or assisted them in aiding the hijack. That's the key question.
Now,
at some point soon, within the next 6 months or so, maybe even before the end of the year, Saudi government will move again to dismiss the case. And that's when, the evidence will be presented here. If the court is convinced, that the plaintiffs have come up with insufficient evidence, the case would be dismissed. If not, and the Saudis, motion to dismiss is rejected again, then, what they call discovery in the case will open up much more broadly. And the plaintiffs will then be allowed to look at what happened in Florida and Arizona and these other locations. So that will be a very critical period. And whether they file that before the end of the year or not, it should be sometime mid-year next year when the court rules on that, maybe in the spring.
So in other words, if the case isn't dismissed, that could broaden the scope of of the fact discovery to Sarasota.
Yes. And places like Arizona, where there was a lot of action out there involving the hijackers, and in Virginia and in northern New Jersey, there were a bunch of different places. So, yeah, things could get extremely interesting.
In regards to the recent announcement, which I think a lot of people have been confused by it, President Biden did an executive order, and people, I think, thought that this was an executive order for the declassification of documents related to 9/11, but it's actually a call for review. Do you know much about that? Could you explain it to my listeners?
Yes, it was what they call an executive order, in which he instructed the Attorney General and the heads of various agencies to conduct what are called declassification reviews of records. And he gave various deadlines for it. The most, for the earliest deadline is actually on Saturday, September 11th, for them to review what I have been told is a 16-page FBI document that was a summary of Operation Encore. And, so we'll find out very soon whether or not documents are going to start to be released here. And if that document is released, it could really open the floodgates here. Now, whether or not these documents will show anything significant in terms of evidence, I wrote a story yesterday, I believe it was, about how the Saudis are saying in their court filings, they got some very good lawyers, and they're basically saying, hey, look, even if this stuff is released, there's not going to be anything in there of any significance.
Now, that's the article, I believe it's entitled, Saudi Arabia, FBI closed 9/11 probes without charges, no reason to believe it will reveal powerful new evidence. People can read that article at the Florida Bulldog. Is there anything else people should know?
We should probably say it's floridabulldog.org is where you can find some of it.
Is there anything else people should know with regards to this executive order and this review of documents? If we do get the documents, is it possible that we may get something new out of this?
I think there's a very good chance that there's going to be a lot of new information coming out here. And we'll just have to wait and see. But what's very interesting about this is the way that the executive order is phrased. This stuff has to start happening quickly, including as quickly as Saturday. And then there's other deadlines of 30 days and 60 days and 180 days, you know, for various different types of information here. But given the fact that I've been watching this for 10 years, everything has been moving at a glacial pace. This is, if this happens the way it appears it's going to happen, this will not be a glacial pace. This is going to be significant and fast.
So before we start closing out, one thing I wanted to ask about and inquire about is, you know, we've talked about some of the key players and, you know, names from the Saudi end of things. Is there anyone that we should discuss with regards to figures stateside that have been involved in potential obstruction of this case?
I would say just the FBI itself, frankly. I mean, they have at every turn guarded this stuff like it's a state secret. And we know from past documents that have been classified as secret for national security reasons and were later released, that they really weren't national security. And by that, the prime example is what was called the 28 pages that people may remember from a few years ago. They were released on the orders of President Obama after there was a sort of a hue and cry that they come out. The 28 pages were from Bob Graham's committee. They were censored. Bob Graham didn't like it, but they had agreed to obtain information from the FBI if they would agree to the FBI's conditions. And the FBI made certain conditions on this information, and that's why it was kept secret for all these years. Anyway, when it finally came out, what we found was that there was no real national security information, but there was some embarrassing information, most notably about Prince Bandar, who was the Saudi ambassador. We learned that his private phone number for his multi-million dollar ranch in Colorado was found in the address book of a guy named Abu Zubaydah, who was arrested in Pakistan not long after 9/11 by the FBI. And he's being held in Guantanamo, or has been held in Guantanamo ever since. He was supposedly a top Al-Qaeda operative. What was his, what was Bandar's phone number doing in his little black book?
I also wanted to ask, are there any figures that we could speak of that have been supportive in trying to get these documents released? I know that Ken Williams, an FBI agent retired from Arizona, has been involved with the 9/11 families. We talked about Bob Graham. Are there any other, I guess, heroes in this sort of story?
Well, oddly enough, Congress. You know, I mean, you know, we have a Congress that otherwise is in gridlock or partisan politics here. But when it comes to this 9/11 stuff, they're in unison about turning this over. I mean, you know, a few years ago, they overrode Obama's veto of the JASTA measure to allow this lawsuit to continue. So there have been a number of notables that have been out front. Senator Blumenthal, for instance, Senator Schumer, you know, the representatives from the areas where, you know, people were killed. So, so yeah, there has been some, you know, they put the pressure on to make things happen. And frankly, you got to give credit to Biden here. Assuming things happen as it would appear that they're going to happen. We'll see. If these documents come out, it's going to be because Biden allowed them to come out. So we'll know soon enough.
I wanted to ask you, since you've been involved with journalism for a long time, you've seen a lot. I feel that this case I think obviously it's very important to the 9/11 families. I think it really matters to them. And, you know, I really support their efforts. I also think that this has a lot of broader implications for society. I think that we live in a moment where there's been a long-term sort of erosion in trust of our institutions. I mean, you know, we can go back to Watergate and then Iran-Contra. Do you think maybe getting to the bottom of these unanswered questions and, you know, these classified documents, do you think it could have an effect on renewing trust in our institutions?
Certainly can't hurt. I think it goes back further. I think it goes back significantly to the Warren Commission. But it's also interesting that with the Warren Commission, when they did their thing, they put out 26 thick volumes. I mean, they would stack up, you know, like this long, that included all the evidence that they looked at. And, you know, you can, obviously there's been a lot of contention about the, you know, what they found and whether or not they were right and Oswald and all this stuff. But the one thing that you can't fault them for was everything that they had, they put out there for public consumption. And that's not what's occurring here. All this has been treated as if it is a state secret when it's not. The American public deserves to know what happened here. This was a major, event in our history. And we need to know what happened. And they need to tell us what happened and what they know. And, you know, that's where I'm coming from on this. I just want to see this come out because I've now, when this began, I have not covered 9/11 at all. I was working for a business newspaper. I covered federal courts. And it wasn't until Tony hooked up with me 10 years later that I got involved in this. But since then, I've met a number of family members, survivors of 9/11, who have some, you know, heartbreaking and fascinating stories to tell. And these people are owed an explanation for what happened to them and what happened to their loved one. So that's what it's all about for me.
In closing, I also wanted to mention with the Florida Bulldog, you also have a really recent article by Robin Swan, who we mentioned earlier, Tony Summers' wife. I don't know if you could briefly give my listeners a sketch of what that's all about. Secret pre-9/11 report says widespread Al-Qaeda sleeper cells in America that CIA, FBI were ill-equipped to counter.
Yeah, it was about, about the millennium. I don't know if everybody remembers here, but back when the millennium was rolling around, in 2000, there was all sorts of concerns that there were going to be terrorist attacks and the stuff didn't actually materialize. There was what was called a Millennium After Action Report that was done by an intelligence group. Forget the name. It's in the story, which was published earlier today. They examined this, you know, what had happened, and they essentially found that came to the conclusion that there were lots of sleeper cells, Al-Qaeda sleeper cells around the country, and that the FBI and the CIA essentially weren't up to the task of, you know, keeping an eye on them. And there was concern about what was going to happen in the future. So the story details all this.
And I would highly recommend people read that and also just all the articles at Florida Bulldog. I think you're an important watchdog group, especially for Floridians. How can my listeners keep up with your work? Just floridabulldog.org, right?
Yeah, floridabulldog.org. And we are reader supported. And we accept contributions, and you can do it on site if you want. And you can, since we're a 501c3, an accredited 501c3, all donations are deductible. We list, by the way, everybody that gives us money and by name. costs because we think it's important for transparency purposes that people know where we're getting our money. And so there you have it.
Well, thank you again, Dan Christensen, for coming on Parallax Views.
All right, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dan Christensen of the Great Florida Bulldog website. There should be even more news coming out relating to the 9/11 victims' families lawsuit coming very soon. So keep an eye on the Florida Bulldog. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. I should be releasing some new content this Sunday, tomorrow, and I really, really, really would appreciate if you enjoy this program, getting your support at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There's the $1, $5, $10, and $15 tiers available. Any amount will help, and I really, really need it. As I've stated on previous shows, I am now taking in a family member who has fallen upon hard times, and, you know, I could really use some donations to keep this program going. It is my full-time job, and I really appreciate all the existing contributors to the program on patreon.com/parallaxviews. And I should note, at the $10 and $15 tiers, you get a producer's credit shout out. So it's that time again. Producer's credit shout outs to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Ed, Gratz, James, Jamie, Mickey, Brian, The War Nerd, Emilia, Chase, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.